This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the president canceled his travel plans today to discuss the country's response to Ebola with his cabinet. We'll check out the political response to Ebola in our weekly look at Congress.
First, we're talking about a federal judge's decision to block the political campaign coordination law in Wisconsin.
U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa said state election officials and a prosecutor in Milwaukee can no longer limit the ability of candidates and outside groups to collaborate. Earlier this year, Judge Randa issued a similar decision that halted an investigation into collaboration between Governor Scott Walker's campaign and conservative groups during the recall election. That investigation is also known as John Doe 2.
Here to break down the news and give us some context is Patrick Marley. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions and the Fight for Wisconsin. Patrick, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again.
So let's start with this ruling. What exactly did Judge Randa say?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
What exactly did Judge Randa rule yesterday?
So he ruled in a lawsuit brought by Citizens for Responsible Government. They're the group that started the recall movement 15 years ago in Milwaukee County. They say that they want to have a website, an ad campaign, where they work directly with candidates. But they feared to do that because the Government Accountability Board, the State Elections Agency, and Milwaukee County's DA, John Chisholm, have a view of the law that you cannot do that. And so Randa yesterday said, yes, they can go ahead and do that, that the GAB and Chisholm cannot enforce their view of the law that groups and candidates can work together.
Now, on what grounds did the Citizens for Responsible Government advocates sue the Government Accountability Board and the Milwaukee County District Attorney?
Well, they are saying under the First Amendment that they have that right, that as long as they don't engage in what's known as express advocacy, where they directly tell people, vote for this candidate or vote against that candidate, that they can associate with whoever they want to and run any kinds of communications that they want. So all they have to do is avoid the so-called magic words. They can't say vote for or support, but they can say that candidate A is a great person and candidate B is a terrible person. You see lots of ads on TV around election time that the normal voter wouldn't realize is not technically defined as a campaign ad. These are ones that might end with saying, call Senator so-and-so and tell them to change their stance on X or Y, and it runs just before an election.
So does this mean essentially we're talking about issue ads?
Right. This is what they're saying. Because they're doing issue ads, they believe that they can work directly with candidates, and Judge Randa said that they're right, that they can.
Now, one of the twists in this story is that the defendants didn't have a lawyer until the day before the decision was announced, and that lawyer had asked for more time to respond but didn't get the chance before the decision came down. Why did that decision come so quickly?
So it is an odd wrinkle. The CRG sued only this month and asked for immediate relief because they said they wanted to engage in this before the November 4 election. The Attorney General refused to represent Chisholm and the Accountability Board because of other cases related to this John Doe that he's involved in, and saying he does not agree with their interpretation of the law. So when the Attorney General refused to represent them, it then fell to Governor Walker's office to appoint counsel for them. Governor Walker's chief counsel asked Judge Randa for more time to find attorneys and to get a contract with them. Judge Randa said he wanted a quick resolution to this and gave them a matter of days to respond, even though they were telling him that they didn't have attorneys. And they finally got an attorney on Monday. The attorney on Tuesday asked Randa for another week to respond because he'd just been hired. Judge Randa said he was ruling because the election was so close and that the attorneys could try to make their case for him to change his mind a week from now.
So with the election a mere 3 weeks away, is this ruling likely to affect the elections?
Well, CRG is now free to start their campaign. They I don't know that they have yet. I mean, they just got the ruling yesterday. They say they want to start a website called Take Charge Wisconsin. It does not appear to be active to me so far. The candidates that they are working with are some county board members. Those are the elected officials that they're working with. So it's not, they're not saying that they're working with candidates in major races. This would presumably give candidates for governor, for attorney general, for the legislature to start working with outside groups if they wanted to. We have not heard so far that anybody plans to do that. If they were to do that, they would have to be aware that, you know, this continues to be in litigation, that appeals could be filed, that Randa could change his views, or that another court could rule a different way.
How does this ruling affect campaign finance law in Wisconsin?
Well, it's an important ruling. It's not the last ruling on the issue. I think that we will see other courts, perhaps the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal court in Chicago for our region, getting involved at some stage in this case. There are three cases before the state Supreme Court on aspects of the campaign finance law through the John Doe case, and that court could rule at some point. So I think at some point, and I don't know if it's weeks or months or a year or more away, we're going to get some finality on this issue, but at the moment it's extremely fluid.
If it were to stand for any amount of time, how significant would that be?
Well, it depends on your point of view. The groups like CRG and the Wisconsin Club for Growth believe that this has been the law all along and they've been able to collaborate with candidates if they want to. So they would say that it would be no change at all. The detractors of that view say that it would be a significant change because you could have candidates and groups working together in a way that would then disguise contributions to a candidate. In other words, normally if a candidate goes out and raises money, there's only a certain amount they can raise from any particular donor, and that's all publicly disclosed. For instance, in a race for governor, the maximum amount they can raise is $10,000. Now they could go raise money for a third party of, say, $1 million from a given donor. And if that person gave to groups that were structured the right way, that would never be known by the public.
Has the Supreme Court given any indication about how it feels or would feel about this kind of collaboration?
The state Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has changed a lot of laws in recent years on campaign speech, with Citizens United and more recently this case known as McCutcheon, and the court has had closely divided cases that have tended to be on the side of less regulation, not more. However, the critics of those decisions point out that the court has also drawn a line between activities that are truly independent by outside groups, allowing them a lot more freedom, and groups that work with a candidate, putting them in a different category.
Now, this is part of the larger ongoing issues behind the John Doe investigation. How significant is this ruling as the next part of that story, which seems to still be unfolding?
Well, I mean, if the Citizens for Responsible Government prevail in their case, it would seem to me to be a significant help to Governor Walker and the groups allied with him who have been under investigation, because if the courts were to say that all this activity is perfectly legal, then there wouldn't be any problem for him. Now, those groups say that, they've already had some court decisions that have been favorable to them. This would be something else that would strengthen their hand in that matter.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and co-author of the book More Than They Bargained For, Scott Walker, Unions, and the Fight for Wisconsin.
It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today Politics and Congress editor Paul Singer. The president has canceled political travel today to meet with his cabinet to discuss the country's response to Ebola. This morning, news of a second infection of a Dallas nurse was announced.
And as we stand 3 weeks away from midterm elections, a lot of attention has been focused on a possible Republican takeover of the Senate. But what's happening in the House? A political report suggests Republicans could establish their tightest hold there since Truman's presidency.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, thanks for being with us again.
My pleasure. How you doing, Rob?
I'm real good. Well, let's start with Ebola. What role does Congress play potentially in responding to a threat like this?
Well, you'll remember that about a month ago, Congress passed a supplemental spending bill that included $88 million for the administration's response on Ebola. And then a couple of weeks later, they approved a Defense Department, we call it a reprogramming. Basically, the Defense Department wanted to move some money out of one set of accounts into another set of accounts. That was another $750 million. At this point, you know, the White House says they are in the process of allocating $1 billion to Ebola response. So far, they've only allocated about $311 million of that, but that's kind of, you know, it takes a while to get rid of $1 billion. So at the moment, honestly, there's not a lot Congress needs to do, or for that matter can do. They're not even here. I think the next turn of the screw becomes the current funding bill that expires December 11th. We will need a new funding bill to keep the government open for the rest of the year, that is, for the rest of the fiscal year. I think there's no doubt there will be talk about increasing allocations for Ebola and for probably for CDC to develop vaccines and stuff like that in that bill, but that won't be until early December.
Now, there's no shortage of world crises these days, so with so much competing bad news, how has the conversation in Congress on Ebola evolved over the last several months?
Well, you know, it's funny. We were just talking about the other day, whatever happened to NSA spying? You remember when that was a big deal? And we went and did some calling around, and it registers nowhere in the polls. It registers nowhere in campaigns. Now it's all about Ebola, you know, this week. You know, what now happens is a blame game starts where you'll see Democrats accusing Republicans of starving the CDC and other government agencies that would be and that are the primary responders to Ebola. And you see Republicans responding that, in fact, these agencies have not been starved. They've simply been misdirecting their resources that they've been given. And, in fact, they're doing fine in funding. It's just a question of dumb spending of that money. So Congress, in its typical mood at this point, they're not here. They're not working on much, but they are blaming each other for what's not going right.
And the editorial board at USA Today published an opinion piece suggesting that politicians were overreacting, using this for political gain, as you were just kind of outlining. You know, you're separate from the editorial board, but have we seen that much in the nature of alarmism in the response?
Alarmism is the... I mean, you know, honestly, we have this conversation every morning at our... morning news meeting, right? Are we being alarmist? You know, are we telling people about an important and scary health situation, or are we fanning the flames of panic? It's, you know, I honestly have very mixed feelings about both our coverage and everybody else's coverage. You know, we want to be responsible. We want to be telling the story. I think politicians have the same problem. They want to be telling the story. They want to be informing their constituents. And to some degree, of course, they're running for office. They want to be making a political point about the philosophical decisions that lawmakers have made and how those either help or hurt us in these situations. But at the same time, you don't want to be telling people, you know, screaming fire in a crowded movie theater.
Now, turning to midterm elections, Republican control of the Senate is being talked about these days as likely. And in Kentucky, the Senate Democrats' national campaign is no longer buying ads for Mitch McConnell's challenger, Alison Lundergan Grimes.
Right, now, but I'll warn you on that. I'll warn you on that. That is true. But she's also got a $5 million war chest of her own. So it's not like she's gone away.
So
but
is
yes,
this not
right.
as significant as it may seem to be that they're giving up on her because it seems likely that she's going to lose, which is one narrative that's out there?
I think she's likely to lose, but it's a pretty close race. One narrative out there is that the Democrats are abandoning her because they think she's going to lose. Another narrative is that the Democrats are shifting their money elsewhere because they have less well-funded challengers that they really want to try and push, or, for that matter, incumbents they want to save. I think winning Kentucky has always been a bit of a pie-in-the-sky chance for them. You don't usually beat the sitting Republican leader, minority leader in the Senate. I think they think they've got a pretty good shot, the best shot they're going to have. And I think they think that spending a lot more money in that race is not as fruitful as spending money where they really need to rescue some endangered incumbents, whether it's in Iowa, or it's not an incumbent there, but a Democratic seat, or in Louisiana or in Arkansas where there are incumbents. That is my suspicion of the calculus.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about the Senate possibly changing control. Let's talk about the House. Everybody pretty much agrees that the Republicans are going to stay in control. At one point, though, Democrats were talking like they might make limited gains there. That seems to be changing. Is it looking likely that Republicans will score, you know, further wins in the House?
Yeah. Democrats were talking about wins in the House. Nobody else was. That was never really likely to happen. The guesses all along have been somewhere between 6 and 10 pickup seats for the House Republicans, which would solidify their majority. I think the question is, do they pick up 20 seats? That would be fairly dramatic. And would, as you think you're mentioning at the top of the show, you know, establish the strongest majority for them in many years. It would also, frankly, be something of a validation of John Boehner's speakership. Remember, you know, at the beginning of the year, people were talking about, oh, John Boehner is weakened by his Tea Party caucus, and the Republicans are going to vote for somebody else for speaker, and, you know, it's proved they can't actually steer this ship well. I mean, if the Republicans win 5 or 6 seats, okay, you know, maybe we still have that argument. If Republicans win 20, suddenly Boehner looks like a champ.
And now let's look at some of the issues in the congressional races. A while back, we were talking a lot about Obamacare as an important talking point in Republican campaigns. Just a few weeks out, are things shaping up that way?
Well, you still see some of it. It's still of interest to people. What's interesting to me is that some of the Democrats have begun defending their votes on Obamacare. They don't call it that, of course. They say stuff like, I'm very proud that I voted to allow you to be covered for pre-existing conditions or to allow your children to stay on your health care plan. Right. They never say, I voted for Obamacare. The name is still toxic. I don't think Republicans are making as much headway as they thought they might on Obamacare. Certainly not, you know, 9 months ago when it looked like this was going to be the issue of the campaign, because they've got a bunch of other things to talk about now, right? They've got government incompetence in general. I think there is a sense that the country is drifting in the wrong direction, that the government has not been functional, and that Democrats and President Obama particularly are to blame. That's been the Republican talking point. I think that Obamacare is part of that. Certainly, and in certain races, it can be a very influential issue. But it has not turned out to be the star of the campaign season that we expected.
Well, has everything just sort of disappeared from the radar, as you were just saying, sort of in the wake of ISIS and Ebola in terms of possible campaign talking points?
You know, what has really emerged as the campaign talking point, particularly for Republicans, is Obama bad. And it's everything from Ebola to ISIS to, the economic recovery is not good enough to Obamacare. I mean, the major themes here have been your Democratic candidate X, insert name here, is too close to Barack Obama, and Barack Obama has been bad. And with Obama's performance ratings so low in the public eye, it works. I mean, he was supposed to go on a campaign trip today for the first time all year, basically being on the stage with a Democratic candidate. And, of course, that got canceled so we could stay home and talk about Ebola.
Well, speaking of bad news for President Obama, we speak to former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta today, latest Obama cabinet member to write a memoir with some criticisms of the president. Is it rare to see this kind of criticism from his almost inner circle while still in office?
Not really. I'm surprised to hear it from Leon Panetta because, we've known him in Washington for years, and he's always been a fairly temperate kind of guy. He was a member of Congress. He was, Secretary of Defense. He was a CIA. I mean, he's had every position in Washington you can imagine, and you don't expect him to be the guy to blab and kiss and tell, as it were. But no, if you want to leave the administration and make a little bit of money on your book, it helps if you say something sexy and nasty about the president, and it happens all the time. Every administration around this time, you will see former administration official writes books saying, my bosses were morons.
Is this in any way, do you think, a move by Panetta on behalf maybe of Panetta and some others behind him of looking ahead to the next presidential election?
I don't know. I mean, I think mostly it's a move to sell books. Whether it's I don't doubt Mr. Panetta's view, right, that he feels like he was not listened to and bad advice was being pursued by the administration, and they were just trying to get out of Afghanistan and Iraq as quickly as possible. I mean, I don't doubt that. That's not he's not the only one who's ever said that either. But I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's anything more strategic to it than that, that you say it, you get paid a lot of money to write books that say it, you then go on the talk show circuit and talk some more about it, and then you move on.
Paul, thanks a lot for being on the talk show circuit with us today.
Yeah, where's my check?
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us each week at this time to give us the latest from Congress. Author and social commentator Katha Pollitt has long written about abortion rights. Her new book is dedicated entirely to the issue, and she isn't just addressing pro-life advocates.
In Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, she addresses those who are pro-choice but still see abortions in a negative light as shameful or secretive. She says that instead they should be seen as a social good and a common part of a woman's reproductive life.
40 years after the U.S. Supreme Court decided that abortions are constitutional in the case of Roe v. Wade, dialogue about the issue is not over and still fiercely divided.
Katha Pollitt joins us now. Katha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you write that 1 in 3 women in America have an abortion by the time they reach menopause. Considering how common it is, why do you see abortions as something that carries so much shame?
Well, I think that it carries shame because we don't know how common it is. Everybody thinks they're alone. And the stereotypes flourish in that silence, of the stereotypes being the slutty teenager, the child-hating, cold-hearted career woman, the welfare queen. Most people know someone who's had an abortion, but they don't know that they know.
A big part of this book is you making the case that abortion needs to come out of the closet, you say, and be claimed as a positive social good. So in brief, how do you make the case for abortion as something that's good for society?
Well, I think it's good for society if women have children when they are best able to mother those children. And this is good for women, it's good for children, and it's good for men too. I think the idea that the best thing for society is for women to have pregnancies in a random kind of way because there's a birth control accident or they didn't use birth control that time and therefore should be punished by having a baby, I don't think this is a way to have a society where people get to be their best selves.
Now, abortion is still a hot-button word, just in a different way than it may have been, you know, in the 60s or 70s. And you say, do you just the word abortion today, and people tend to dig in based on whatever camp they're in. So who are you addressing with this book?
Well, with this book, I think I hope to address two kinds of people. One are people who are totally pro-choice, but they haven't been very active or very public about that because maybe they haven't known how to connect with a social movement, or maybe they're embarrassed or ashamed or busy, or they're complacent too. You know, it's there. It's okay. Nothing bad is going to happen. The other, though, are people who are in what I call the muddled middle, who are people who they don't want abortion to be banned, which, let's remember, is the goal of the anti-abortion movement. They don't want it to be banned. But they want everybody to feel really bad about it. They think there's too much of it. They want women to feel guilty. Maybe it's too easy to get abortion. It shouldn't be birth control. You know, you've heard all those things. And those people, by not defending what they actually believe, which is abortion should be legal, are allowing those who want to ban abortion to make tremendous gains politically.
Isn't abortion, you know, by necessity personal and intimate, even though, you know, it can be debated publicly? Isn't this something that will carry emotional baggage no matter what we say or how we choose to frame it?
Well, it might. It might. I mean, women have many, many different responses to their abortions. We hear a lot about women who regret their abortions, which the anti-abortion movement wants you to think is the typical or indeed universal experience, which is not at all true. My point is, for most women, it's not like that. For most women, there's a feeling of great relief, and they move on. But the point I'm trying to make is that our feelings about our own abortions or about other people's abortions is not what the law should be about, and it isn't what the law is about in other things. You know, consider a divorce, right? Divorce, people regret their divorce. They're happy about their divorce. They're angry about their divorce. They judge other people's divorces very freely. But we can still all agree that it's a very good thing socially for divorce to be available. And it is available in every state, and pathetic little attempts to roll that back never get anywhere because everybody recognizes that that this is a right that people really need and that overall contributes to human happiness. And so I think the same is true about abortion, that whatever you think about your own abortion or someone else's, it's a social good, which means having it available and accessible is good on the whole for the whole society.
Now, this ended up being more of a personal book than, you know, we might have expected. This, you found out that your mother had had an abortion. She hadn't told anyone about it. How did that end up affecting you and this book?
Well, I don't know that she hadn't told anyone about it. She hadn't told me about it. I guess for me, that made me an example of what I'm writing about, which is the person who knows someone who had an abortion, but they don't know that they know. And in my case, it was my own mother. Now, another person in my family who had an abortion was my great-grandmother 100 years ago in World War I in Russia. And she had, I thought it was 8 children, but actually my cousin tells me it was 9 children. And then she had an abortion and she died, an illegal abortion, and she died. So the idea that abortion is specific to our own society, that it happens after Roe v. Wade comes in 1973, this is false. Abortion has been incredibly common all over the world for thousands of years.
Right. Let's talk about some of that history, because you dive into some of it going back to the Bible when you say the Bible did not prohibit abortion. Could you take us back through there briefly and tell us what changed?
Well, what's interesting about the Bible is that people who are opposed to legal abortion on religious grounds believe that the Bible forbids abortion. But actually, the word abortion is never mentioned in the Bible, and the procedure abortion is never described in the Bible. And so they have to rely on extrapolation. King David says, you know, you knit me in my mother's womb, he says, of God. Well, this is obviously poetry, but that somehow is supposed to mean abortion. We have to ban abortion. Horrible descriptions of pregnant women being murdered in war. Somehow that's supposed to mean ban abortion. But actually, there's nothing about abortion in the Bible. And it's interesting that people think that it's there when it isn't. And in fact, many denominations permit abortion, and some denominations that now say are totally anti-choice, like the Southern Baptists. Back in the 60s, the Southern Baptists said, yes, we have to liberalize abortion laws. They're too strict.
So what happened to change the religious beliefs about abortion that now so strongly underpin that point of view?
Well, I think a lot of things. One was that conservatives mobilized conservative religious people to form the religious right, and that got connected with the Republican Party and became incredibly strong in the Republican Party. And so they're very powerful in one party and much less so in another, although not non-existent in the Democratic Party, I need to point out. And so once you have that all mobilized, then you're good to go when it comes to laws and appointing judges and things like that. But I think another thing is that a lot of people just feel, you know, it was better before. Now there's just too much sex. America's going to hell in a handbasket. Look at these women out there. Nobody's responsible. I think the anti-abortion movement connects with a feeling a lot of people have that we're moving very strongly in too permissive a direction and that this is very bad.
Well, now, 40 years ago in Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court ruled that abortions are constitutional in the United States. But we've seen new alarm from abortion rights supporters who reference politicians who talk about legitimate rape, or they support admitting privileges for doctors who perform abortions, waiting periods before abortions. Do you feel like the legality of abortions is still in jeopardy?
Well, I think that access is the more important problem. It could be that, you know, when and if the Supreme Court ever looks at Roe v. Wade again, they'll say, no, no, we still think this is the law of the land. But simultaneously, so many restrictions on clinics and on women's ability to get an abortion at those clinics will be in existence throughout the country that for abortion will be out of reach of, you know, millions of women, as in fact it already is. See, that's the terrible thing. I mean, if there is one clinic in Missouri, a big state with a, you know, with a big city, St. Louis, there's one clinic and they have for all those women, and they have just passed a 72-hour waiting period. How available is abortion to a woman that doesn't live in St. Louis? You know, she has to get there. She has to stay there for 3 days. She has to find childcare. She has to take time off work. This ratchets up the cost tremendously. So I think that, you know, on the books, abortion is legal in Missouri. There's that one clinic. That's not enough. In effect, abortion is very, very hard to get. It's in effect banned for a lot of women.
We're speaking right now with Katha Pollitt. She's an author and a columnist for The Nation. Her new book is called Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Katha Pollitt says abortion should be seen as a social good, as a normal part of women's reproductive lives. Do you agree with that or disagree? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're back with Nation columnist Katha Pollitt talking about her new book called Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Katha Pollitt says abortion should be seen as a social good, a normal part of women's reproductive lives. What do you think about that? And she says many who consider themselves pro-choice still see abortions as shameful. Do you agree? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers now. We've got Daniel joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
So I wanted to say that I think you guys, the pro-choice movement, is really missing a large younger generation of non-religious conservatives to a couple of points. The first is that, you know, the how much of a person, you know, a fetus is, I feel like alienates a lot of people who think that that's, you know, it's a kind of silly argument to something that should be the individual liberties of owning your body and no one really being able to tell you what to do with it. And the other point is that I feel like it should be a women's issue. But I don't think it will be an exclusively women's issue, abortion, until rules change pertaining to, you know, the financial responsibility of the male part of that equation, because it's a very important and very personal and very emotional decision for a woman to make. But as it sits right now, it's, you know, it's a 18-year financial commitment to the male part of that equation, and I feel like that brings more people to the argument table than it should.
Okay, thanks a lot for your thoughts, Daniel. And Katha's taking his last point first about how financially it is something that involves men quite a bit. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I think that's really part of a different conversation. But certainly, if that's what men are worried about, having to pay child support, they should be very much in favor of legal abortion and of accessible abortion. I would love to see men more involved on the pro-choice side. They should also maybe be a little more enthusiastic about using birth control, so that there would be maybe a few fewer of these accidental pregnancies. You know, I wanted to get back to the first thing that he said, where he talked about how for young non-religious conservatives, the argument over the personhood of the fetus is kind of silly. I was a little confused, but I think that's what he said. And I want to just expand on that a little bit because, yes, to believe that a fertilized egg, it has one cell, is a person, and that therefore, you know, its rights equal or even exceed that, in fact, do exceed that of the woman, the pregnant, the not yet pregnant woman, is really very hard to feature logically. It's really – it's a religious position. I don't think that everybody should be governed by the beliefs of, you know, sectarian religion.
In terms of the arguments of both sides of this issue being issues that resonate with them, according to the Gallup poll in 1996, 33% of Americans considered themselves pro-life. Today, 46% of Americans consider themselves pro-life. Why do you think that number has increased during the past nearly 20 years?
Well, I think that the pro-life so-called movement has been very successful. I think it is a grassroots movement. And I think that it, especially in, you know, in some places more than others, is that's what it means to just be a normal person. That's just life. And so when a pollster says, are you pro-life or are you pro-choice? Of course you say, I'm pro-life because that's what a good person is. That's what a Christian is. That's what everyone I know says they are. But here's something interesting, and I don't mean to say that it's trivial that people describe themselves in this way, but something that's very interesting is that when you ask people pro-life or pro-choice, pollsters then assume that the people who say those things line up politically the way the organized movements do, so that a person who says they're pro-life means, I want abortion to be very hard to get, I want it to be banned, I want women to be forced to have children if they're pregnant. But that one-third of people who say they're pro-life also say they're pro-choice. So what they're really saying is, I wouldn't have an abortion, or I don't like the idea of abortion. I wish we didn't have so much abortion, stuff like that. But yes, I think it should be legal.
All right. I want to thank Daniel for his questions. And let's move next to Mary, who is in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'd like to say I've had an abortion myself. I do find it something very difficult to discuss because you worry about how people are going to view you, and that they might try to prosecute you or treat you differently. I even have a hard time talking about it now, but I know that I made the right choice for myself and for my family. And even though I wish I hadn't gotten myself into that situation, I take pride in the fact that I know that I did what was best for us.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Mary. I appreciate you sharing that with us. And, you know, Mary, obviously emotional as she talks about this here. Katha, one of the things you ask feminists to do who are supporting the pro-choice end of the equation is to stop being apologetic. But, you know, as Mary illustrates, it can be very difficult to talk about. What stance should women take? What's the right one as you see it?
Well, I think that the more women can talk openly with people that they know, where it's safe for them to do so. I mean, Mary has, you know, has legitimate fears about how people will feel about her. But the more people can talk about this and their own experiences, I think the less stigmatized abortion will be. And that would be a very good thing. Look how gays and lesbians transformed the way Americans think about gays and lesbians by coming out, right? So that instead of it being some abstraction or some caricature or some stereotype, suddenly the gay person was your Uncle Ben and the lesbian was your colleague, Carol, at work. So that's so wonderful that the gay movement was able to do that. And I think women can do that. I think that, you know, it would have been a good thing if my mother had told me she'd had an abortion, because then it would have given me a much more realistic sense of what sex was all about than I had as a very romantic young person.
You mentioned that your divorce is something that has been equated with a social good now, a choice that people should have. And same-sex marriage, as you said, has become normalized, and people are becoming more accepting of that in many cases across this country, certainly. But will abortion ever be in that same camp? Is there something that's just qualitatively different about that experience and, you know, more personal in a way?
Well, it's more I don't think anybody should have to justify their abortion to anybody. And so if that's what you're asking about, you know, will it ever be that you say, I had an abortion, and everybody in the world is going to say, well, that's wonderful, dear. I don't think you owe anybody an explanation. It's really your own. It's your body. It's your life. It's your sense of what makes your life possible and good. And maybe it's associated with sad things in your life, too. That's another thing, like you lost a relationship. You had to have the abortion for a sad reason, like there was something wrong with the baby, or there was – and yes, I did use that word baby, so now everybody's going to call and say, aha, she used that word baby. You know, abortion is part of the full range of human experience, and I think that we can work toward a time when – there will not be this torrent of horrible judgment and abuse on women who are doing the best they can, often in very difficult circumstances.
Now, as we wrap up here, women's bodies are still the subject of public comment, public debate, in the abortion issue certainly, but also beyond that. Do you see that changing anytime soon?
Well, you know, we're at a moment, a very strange moment in American culture where judgment of women is really what popular culture rides on. You know, think of reality television, think of tabloids, think of the incredible judgments that are made of women's bodies. You know, you're 5 pounds, quote, overweight, unquote, everybody gets down on your case. Oh, but then you lose 5 pounds. Oh, no, now you're anorectic, you know. There is just this vicious delight in putting women down in every conceivable way, which I think is a reaction to feminism, actually, that, you know, is trying to shut women up. They occupy too much social space. We have to push them out. Now that I've forgotten your question, I'm sorry. I do think that abortion fits into that. That there's no right way to be for a woman in America.
We leave it there. Katha, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Katha Pollitt, author and columnist for The Nation, about her new book called Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. And you can continue this conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.